Hello and welcome to Open Mind UFO Radio. That's right, we are back. I am back from doing conferences and having trips and all that for good stuff. Although I'm going to have some trips coming up, but we'll talk more about that later. And I'm going to bring you along virtually. But my name, if you were unaware, and this is maybe the first time you've heard the show, is Alejandro Rojas. And I am here with my buddy, Martin, and he's the one who came up with his nickname today, Martin Downer Willis.
Well, for those first-time listeners, I'm not always a downer.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
You're not always a downer. But then the reason why I'm calling him that is because before we started the show, you know, we're talking about the hurricanes, because I had seen some hurricane damage on my trip and all of that. And he's talking about how the weather's not going to get better, how we're all screwed. And that's
Mr. Sunshine. Yeah.
That reminds me, you'll love this story. So Linda Howe was at the conference, and she's got some interesting perspectives. And a friend of ours, one of our volunteers, I just saw this last weekend. She's great. Marianne Robb, love her to death. She's actually a police officer here in Gilbert. But she spent some time with Linda Howe, and she was like, she said she was crying. She was going to get out of the UFO field. She was so freaked out because Linda Howe told her that, you know, remote viewers are seeing floods and devastation, and we're all screwed. By 2020, we're going to be all dead. And she was freaked out. So I was like,
wow.
You know, we were all like, chill out, chill. Doesn't mean that's really going to happen. And she's over it. But I guess she got really freaked out by listening to Linda Howe.
Well, you know, there's been doomsdays around since day number one, mm-hmm. You know, doomsdayers.
Yeah.
So, but, you know, I don't know about the remote viewing. How can you see into the future with the remote viewing?
Yeah, I know. One of the key tenets that, you know, I read a lot of the remote viewing books, and one of the main guys, McMonagle is his name, and he wrote over and over again, and some of the others, that you have to have verifiable data. Like, it's no good if you don't have verifiable data. So really, most of their remote viewing was remote viewing stuff they can verify so they can determine how accurate they were. And the best remote viewers were 20% accurate. And so what that means is when they're remote viewing an unknown, you know, if they're a good remote viewer, then you would know that maybe 20% of the information is something you can do something with. So let's say they give you 10 leads, you know, only two of those will work. But like John Alexander pointed out when I interviewed him about this once, was that's better than nothing. If you're looking at a cold case and you've got nothing, even, you know, a couple, some leads to actually follow up, even if can be helpful. So that's what's interesting about it. But still, if you're not honing your practice, as they put it, you know, and getting feedback, and that was the most important thing, is getting feedback as to your accuracy, then, you know, your skill is going to deplete, and you're not going to know how accurate you are. So, I mean, yeah, 20% best when people are remote viewing all of this really wild and crazy stuff. I think people have to keep that in mind that, you know, the best remote viewers are 20% accurate. So
that means only 20% of the Earth's population will die.
Yeah, good point.
Wow, yeah.
That's so, the way to look at the glass half full right there.
Right. Mr. Sunshine here.
Yeah, your new nickname is Mr. Sunshine today, although you've been stuck in the snow out there in the cold.
Yeah. Yeah, we have about 3 feet still here in Maine. Mm-hmm. It was Last week we got clobbered. We had, I think, 3 nor'easters in 3 weeks.
Oh my gosh.
So, yeah.
I've heard about that wildness that people have been experiencing.
Yeah,
you keep threatening to move to Arizona. I think that perhaps you should. It was in the 40s last night, which is pretty chilly for out here. And it is a little bit chilly now. I think it's around 70 degrees. Sunny.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
So it's pretty nice. It really is. So moving on, my guest for today. And this guest is going to be my guest several times in the next few months. And I hope you'll be happy about that. I am. And that guest is Stanton Friedman. So Stanton Friedman, awesome. I have on tonight, if you're not aware of who he is, he was a nuclear. Sometimes I say nuclear. That damn George Bush taught me that, and I can't get over it.
The library.
Yeah, that's a couple terms that I screw up. Like, I always say library. That one I'm never going to be able to get rid of. It's always going to be a library to me. Plus, that sounds nice. It reminds me of, like, a blueberry or something delicious like that. But, Stanton, we're going to have... He used to be a nuclear physicist and kind of turned ufologist. So, and he's been doing this for decades. When I started in the UFO field... or at least looking into it, he was the guy. He was the guy you saw on TV. He was the go-to guy to be interviewed. He was Mr. UFO. This is before, you know, Richard Dolan or Nick Pope or any of these people. He was the face of ufology. So we'll talk about that somewhat, especially when there was a lull, you know, especially in the 80s, 90s, it wasn't taken as seriously. It was always, you know, when it was presented, it was also debunked at the end. It wasn't really taken for what it was. So things have changed a lot. That's what I wanted to talk to Stanton Friedman about. But actually, I also wanted to talk about how he got started and what it was like, you know, being that one guy out there or you know, when at least some of the very well-known historic figures in this field, like Dr. J. Allen Hynek, who was an astronomy professor and worked on Project Blue Book, or Donald Kehoe, who started the group NICAP. He was a retired Marine officer and worked with a lot of military people looking into UFOs. Those are some of the people he knew who have since passed away. So we talk a lot about that, and it's really interesting. But in upcoming interviews, I want to talk to him more about how things have changed, the state of things today, and his thoughts on that, and why is it so important to talk to him right now? You're the news guy. I think you know.
Are you talking to me?
Yeah.
Well, this is one of those awkward
Why is it so important that I talk to him right now? We get these interviews
Because, you know, he's not going to stay in this forever.
Well... Oh, well, you might not know. He's saying he's retiring.
I do. That's what I meant. Yeah, I did. That's what he said when I saw him out in Phoenix. He said he was going to be retiring soon.
Yeah, and I guess he's been telling people this on interviews as well. So, you know, he told us that at the Congress. But then I've heard from other people, too, that now he's out there saying that. So, and he's very serious about it. So we talked about him retiring here. He's going to be 84 or 85, says in the interview, and I've already forgotten which one it is. But, he feels it's time that he retire. And, you know, there's a big difference from when I first met him to these days, you know, as far as physically. His ability to get around. He says his mind has kind of gotten a little less sharp, but you wouldn't know it.
You wouldn't know it. Yeah. I would never know it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He still really has it. Does he talk about how he very first got into, what made him get into the UFO subject? I love that.
He does.
About the book. Yeah.
No, he didn't tell me about a book. It was something else.
Oh, okay. Do you want me to say what he told me once on an interview?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay, so he was ordering some books from some type of school or library or something like that. And so he would get free shipping if he ordered an extra book. And so he just kind of went to a book and it said UFO on it. And he just like, I'll just order that. So he filled it in and sent it away for it. And he got the UFO book and he was very, very fascinated by it. And that's really how he said to me how he actually got started in looking at the UFO topic.
Do you remember what book it was?
No. But he said he was saying it was because he was too cheap. He says, I'm cheap and that's why I did it. And look where it led me.
That's really funny.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Yeah. So, yeah, he's led an interesting life. And I think hands down, you know, Lee Spiegel's on the show a lot, a journalist, and he's written a lot about UFOs. And he and I were talking the other day, and he brought this up. And I think he's right that hands down, Stan Friedman has done more lectures on this topic than probably anybody in history.
Right.
And the second place person would probably be way, way behind, maybe has done half as much.
Something like 600 or 700 colleges or something like that. So amazing.
We talk about that in this interview too, and why that is and how that happened. And so I think it's really insightful and interesting.
Yeah. He talks about his hecklers. He's only had a few.
Yep. He often talks about his hecklers, but yes, we do talk about that as well. So fun stuff. Yeah, so a great interview. I love this interview, and we'll have more with Stanton coming up as time goes on, and especially to talk about some of the incredible things that are happening lately that are really interesting. Yeah. So why don't we get into that? Let's get into the UFO news with Martin Willis.
Downer Willis? All right. Well, I want to talk about a wonderful blog that was written by one of my favorite people in the UFO field, Linda Zimmerman. And the title to this is St. Patrick's Day UFOs. And some of you may actually still be hungover from St. Patrick's Day. So it starts in 2006. She goes back and looks through time on St. Patrick's Day. And then she actually says why, you know, there are not too many reports in the month of March in general. You know, there are like in warmer places, but around the country. So in 2006, the police in Nahuatl, I don't know exactly how you pronounce that, New York, assumed that there was a high volume of calls reporting UFOs was just a result of too much partying on this festive day. But there were some sober people that were calling in and witnesses to basically a mass sighting. And this was St. Patrick's Day in the Hudson Valley in New York. Actually, that was 35 years earlier. There was one on St. Patrick's Day that she refers to in the Hudson Valley. But she speculates, well, you know, perhaps it's test flights of exotic aircraft on March 17th, realizing that eyewitness reports would be deemed unreliable. She's saying that kind of as a joke on St. Patrick's Day. Or ETs actually know our drinking habits. But anyway, so she goes back into the New Fork database, and it becomes evident that historically March isn't active, but there are some cases on St. Patrick's Day going back to 1969 in Odessa, Washington. There was a brilliant metallic glowing disc-shaped craft with red and blue lights and a circle on the bottom, and was seen by over a dozen witnesses. And when was this exactly? There was one right on I-84 in New York and New York and Western Connecticut. They saw a massive football size, like a silent craft hovering and moving extremely slowly. And I don't really see the date on that particular one. It doesn't really show the date on that one. But this is just going back, looking at all of these different sightings that actually happened on St. Patrick's Day. And there was another one in 1988. And it was very similar to another one in 1969. The sketch is on in the blog itself. And you'll see this weird sketch of this a polygon-shaped item with green lights all the way around it. Fitting, isn't it? Had green lights on St. Patrick's Day?
Yeah.
So anyway, there's a lot of them, 1983, again, 1988, 1969, all on St. Patrick's Day.
Mm-hmm.
And one was a boomerang shaped, one was egg shaped, and this polygon shaped one, there's a picture drawn, sketched by the artist.
Yeah, great article that she wrote for openminds.tv, and it's got tons of likes and stuff. But Linda Zimmerman's wonderful. We're so lucky to have her to contribute. And it was kind of interesting because she sent me a few pictures to include in the article. And she was like, you know, a couple of these, I don't know where they come from, so I'm not sure if you can use them. And I'm very careful about making sure I know where the pictures are come from so I can credit the source and make sure that it's okay if I have any indication that this person, you know, these people don't want their pictures to be shared elsewhere, even with credit, then I won't do it. But it turned out these were Michael Schratt's. And,
oh, I see that.
Yeah. So, and Michael Schratt, he did these probably while he was working with at Open Minds. And Michael Schratt is excellent, I mean, at these graphics. He does the coolest graphics for historical sightings. And he is always very cool about sharing his pictures. So, you know.
Now, doesn't he typically go along the lines that these are military?
Yeah, I mean, he feels that a lot of these seem to be military. I think even this one, he felt there's witnesses kind of described an inner kind of structure, beams and stuff. And so he does feel that it's possible and makes the argument that it's possible that some of these could be, you know, black projects and stuff. So, yeah, it's funny. It's interesting. He's funny.
How do you feel about that? I mean, do you feel like we could actually have a craft and have had it for a decade or two that could hover slowly without any sound?
Highly, highly unlikely.
Hmm.
But, of course, the idea that an extraterrestrial civilization created something and is flying around is also, you know, I think arguably unlikely. So, even though that's a long shot, either one is a bit of a long shot. So who knows? I think that you just can't completely rule it out. Just like you can't rule out that it could be possibly a craft from the future or something. You know,
the last guest I had on is 100%. Well, his thoughts are 100% that they're interdimensional.
And interesting.
You know, I mean, I think if anyone has their thoughts that it's just 100% anything, it's most likely they're going to be wrong.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I agree. Cause there's so many possibilities and it's impossible to rule out, many of these. And, you know, the one from the future's, kind of cool. I was watching this interview just, yesterday, with Neil deGrasse Tyson, essentially showing parts of an interview he did with, Stephen Hawking, who, of course, people probably know passed away just in the last few days.
Right.
And an incredible thinker, of course. And he had Michio Kaku on. He had different guests on where they would show one of the questions and answers from Hawking. And then he had this panel that he would talk to. And they were talking about the possibility of people coming from the future. And he asked Hawking, is it possible people are coming from the future? He says, yeah, it's possible, but if it happens, if it is possible, we probably would have met someone from the future already. And I love that answer because I always ask people, do you believe it's possible that people that one day will travel in time? And if they say yes, then I say, well, that answer also then probably indicates that that would mean it's you would believe it's possible there's someone from the future here right now. So Hawking is going there where it's like, if you believe in time travel, then, you know, that you're believing that, you know, there probably are time travelers here now. And, so I think it's an interesting thought because then they started to discuss how it could be possible. And Michio Kaku then brought in the type 2, type 3 civilizations, this, idea of extraterrestrial civilizations that have advanced technology. And he talked about how it would need to be a more advanced species that could have this something called negative energy, which that's when he lost me. I couldn't understand it. And even Neil deGrasse Tyson said he had a hard time understanding what the heck negative energy was. But I guess it's something that you need to have in order to do time travel, which would be possible. But then Michio Kaku talked about how if you do go back in time, essentially you're creating a new timeline, and that's a different dimension, and it gets really weird.
Well, I also, you know, like if we had the technology, say now, to time travel, and we were going to go back in time, you know, I think the caution would be, you know, don't change anything. So by changing something, does that mean actually
you create another timeline? Anyone? It's impossible to change the past. So if you do something different in the past, you haven't changed your previous past. You have created a new dimension, a new timeline, or at least you're now on a different timeline. So weird stuff.
That is weird.
We've only got a couple minutes left, and of course I'm sure people want to know about the big news, some of the big news that happened, which is the a third video dropped from the To the Stars from the DOD, and there has been a lot of question around this. Of course, my last podcast was the interview with Luis Elizondo from the 2018 International UFO Congress. And the question is and so it's another interesting video where the pilots are obviously baffled by what they're looking at. And what's interesting, though, is that, you know, again, there's not very much information that comes along with the video. So it's the video alone with just talking about, you know, kind of the equipment, also the, you know, the Raytheon kind of equipment that taped this thing, but also talking about, you know, they named this thing the Go Fast and a little bit of background, but not really. It says dates and times were not included at all. However, this video was released in conjunction with a Washington Post article written by Chris Mellon, who, you know, you're one of the few people who's had him on your shows, right? And, yeah. And he is part of this To the Stars, worked for the CIA and then DIA and all of these different groups, a consultant for the Congress and intelligence. And in his article, he's essentially just saying, hey, these incidents are happening. The DOD's not taking this seriously, and they should. But he does give a little bit more information about this video. So he had some information about it. And I'm trying to find what he said. Do you remember?
No, I do know about this particular footage, though. I was contacted by a pilot that said he's actually seen this footage before and didn't think it was ever classified.
Oh, really?
Yes. I'm just looking for that myself right now.
Undisclosed Navy encounter that occurred off the East Coast in 2015.
This is when it was supposed to happen in 2015?
Yeah, the new video happened off the East Coast in 2015, which is more information than what was shared by the To the Stars Academy. So it's another video. It's created another news cycle where, you know, Elizondo has been interviewed again by Fox News, CNN, ABC News have done some stuff. I know Chris Mellon was interviewed, I think, by, was it ABC or MSN? He did an interview anyway on this as well. So, yeah, there's been, it created some more news. But, of course, some people are asking, when are we going to find out more information? Why don't we have more information? And we've heard a little bit about Louise on that, who goes by Lou. But luckily, I'm going to have a chance to hang out with him in another week and a half. And so we'll get answers. I mean, soon we'll be able to to hear from him directly, and hopefully it won't be too long till I have him on this podcast and that we're able to do some more on that.
Does he live on the West Coast?
He currently is on the East Coast, moving to the West Coast.
Ah, I see.
Mm-hmm. But we're out of time.
We're out of time.
Yep, right. That's it for the news. Thank you so much for joining us, Martin.
That's a downer. Yeah, okay.
We'll have Stanton coming up next. For those of you listening to the podcast, you'll hear a short musical interlude. For the rest of you, you'll hear, if you're listening on KGRA, some commercials. But stay tuned. We'll be right back with Stanton Friedman. Very happy to have back to the show a good friend and certainly a mentor and someone I've looked up to for a very long time, Stanton Friedman. Hello.
Good afternoon from beautiful Fredericton, New Brunswick, which has many feet of snow on the ground.
Oh, no. Yeah.
I'm sure you missed that, but...
Yeah, not at all. And you are... You're northeast. You're more northeast than the whole United States, I think. You're in a time zone that's similar to Puerto Rico, way out there on the east.
I'm in the Atlantic time zone. Yeah. Yes, I'm east of Maine.
Chilly, chilly out there. Luckily, I'm not.
It was 10 degrees this morning.
Mm-hmm. So you must enjoy, and we certainly enjoy, for the last few years, even if you don't talk, you coming to the UFO Congress, where it's nice and warm in Phoenix, Arizona.
It sure is, and that is nice.
Yeah, so it's been really cool to have you there, too. I mean, the media...
No, it's been really warm.
Yeah, really warm. Good one. So, and that reminds me, because one of the things that we discovered when you started coming every year to the conference was that the media loves you, and this is a story I'm not sure... I told you this story many years ago. And I'll probably tell it a lot now that we're talking about, you know, we're reminiscing on Stanton stories, and will be probably for some time, and we'll talk about why. But when MUFON first had their symposium in Denver, and I was helping out with that, the media had called, and I talked to this guy with CBS. And, you know, it's hard enough, especially back in, I think this was, well, this was probably early 2000s, but the media wasn't as friendly as they are today to this topic. And the CBS guy said, well, I'd love to talk to someone. It'd be great if I could talk to Stanton. And I said, sure, I can arrange you to talk to Stanton. And he said, really? And I was like, yeah. He's like, Stanton Friedman? I could talk to Stanton Friedman. And the guy was so excited to talk to you because he had seen you on TV so much. And it was kind of, for me, it was an important moment. It kind of was hopeful that, hey, we can gain some ground with the media, and some people do pay attention. And it was the first time I really experienced a media person being so excited about, you know, talking to someone in this field.
Well, I appreciate the story. You know, I got started on the media aspect of this almost by accident. I had called, I was in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, working for Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab on nuclear rockets, one of my many canceled government-sponsored programs. And I was wanted to get on the local talk show on KDKA, big station in town. And the show was called Contact, a great name. And I called, Frank Edwards had given me their name and the name of their producer, and it was... and I told him, you know, Westinghouse nuclear physicist, the Westinghouse big thing in Pittsburgh and so forth. And he was singularly unimpressed. Don't call us. We'll call you. And less than a month later, I get a call at 6:30. Could I please do the show at 7 o'clock? Somebody had canceled at the last minute. And I had to be there in person. So I live not far from the station. But... it turns out I said yes, and that was my first appearance on the media about UFOs. And that led to my first lecture. Somebody at work heard me on this show, and which I didn't do as great a job as I usually do, because frankly, I hadn't a lot of experience in dealing with nasty, noisy negativists and people like that. And somebody at work heard me on the show, asked if I would speak to her book review club, which was reading Frank's book, Flying Saucers, Serious Business. That tells you how long ago this was, obviously. And that was my first show, that radio show, and she had heard me. She asked me to speak. I said yes. I was driving to work one of two times in 3 years with somebody who was a PhD, a supervisor at Westinghouse, a woman. And we were talking. I said, I'd love to speak at Carnegie Mellon University, you know, big school and all that sort of thing. And, her husband was the director of student activities, as it happens. And I had called there and talked to somebody who wasn't interested. She said, well, Stan, he's heard you on the radio. Give him a call. And so I did, and we booked a lecture, and that was my first talk. And there was a peculiar aspect. When we finished, we set a date, but it was in the afternoon, so I'd have to take some time off work. I was still working at Westinghouse. And he asked, how much do you want? And I said, oh, how about $100? I thought he'd knock me down to 50. Well, Gene, that'd be fine. So he booked it. And then he told me what he was, because I knew his wife, but he was paying the other speakers in the series, $1,500, $1,700. Well, that was an introduction to the big time. And the talk went so well, he called the agent through whom he had booked these expensive people. And they booked me at a very important talk for me, the Engineering Society of Detroit, a very respectable organization. And he booked me at $300 in expenses. I'm in a big time here. And that talk made an impression on me because I was a young guy still, a long time ago. They were sold out 2 weeks in advance for 1,008 people for dinner and a talk.
Wow.
And there wasn't one nasty question.
Wow.
And I was impressed, frankly, because I had to respect these people, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few more talks like that. Somehow the word got around, and a colleague at Los Alamos called me up, and we hadn't talked about UFOs. We were in radiation shielding for nuclear rockets. Stan, I understand you're giving lectures about UFOs. Yeah. How about speaking to a local section of the American Nuclear Society? Oh, I'd be delighted. No, I mean on an expense account, Stan. Oh, well, I'll have to ask management about that. I don't make those decisions. And I did, and they said yes. They paid for me to go from Pittsburgh to Los Alamos, New Mexico, to give a lecture. Flying saucers are real, believe it or not. And there were over 400 people at the lecture.
And about what time was that?
You mean when in years?
Yeah.
I would say early. It was in the early 70s, I'd say.
Okay. Wow. Interesting.
Long time ago.
Mm-hmm. So it was, and it was probably at that point, I'm assuming, and this is my question, pretty untouched ground. I mean, Hynek was out there, I guess, during that time.
From time to time, yes.
Donald
Frank
Kehoe.
Edwards had been there,
mm-hmm.
And Kehoe, yes.
But otherwise, which is only a handful compared to today, where there's, you know, dozens of people out there trying to talk about this. So, and not only that, you're very witty. I mean, you're great at interviews. And for instance, not to disparage him, because I'm a big fan of Hynek, I'm sure you are too, but I've heard his lectures were very dry and boring.
They were fairly dry, yes. Mm-hmm. Alan did have a sense of humor, but he was so wary of the attacks of the astronomical community. And as a matter of fact, I introduced him. I arranged for a talk in L.A., and I introduced him, and then he had an official introduction from the chairman of the astronomy department at UCLA. And he said very bad things, not about Alan, but about the subject.
Hmm.
And I was so disappointed because I wouldn't have let anybody get away with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was obvious he didn't know much about the subject. But yeah, it's been a long haul, 700 lectures or so since that time. And look, I am grateful in my old age at having had the opportunity to speak in all 50 states, 10 provinces, 19 other countries, be a ufologist, see the world.
Mm-hmm.
And hope you don't get introduced as a ufologist, of course. But
yeah. Has that happened? That's the first time I've heard that term, but it's a good term.
No, it hasn't happened to me. I don't know about other people, but
yeah.
I'm fortunate in a way. I was in high school debating way back a long time ago in Linden, New Jersey. We had a state championship debating team. And the only reason I got off into lecturing is I was a member of the debating society, and we would won a state championship, and there was a battle between the professor, this teacher who handled that, and the principal of the school, and they canceled debating my last year, my senior year. And so I had to do something, so that's when I got into debating. There was a debate club and so forth. And so what am I going to do? I can't debate. Okay. I went out for two plays. And I am so grateful that I had the opportunity to be on, to be an actor, so to speak. First play was a minor part. Second, would you believe I played a priest with gray hair? And I thought, gee, my dad had been bald since I was 24. So I figured, now I know what I'll look like when I'm if I had gray hair.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I never got bald, and I'm glad.
So,
but that was by accident, you know.
And what's unique, though, about kind of your career, I think also, is that for you started talking, it seemed that, you know, people liked you and thought you were logical and entertaining enough where you did, you know, you did a lot of media interviews. And it seems, at least when I started getting into this in like the 90s, when I was, you know, a kid myself, there, you were like one of the only guys. You were the only real scientist out there. You were one of the, you were like the face of ufology for, it seems, for many, many, many years.
Well, there's some truth to that. And let's face it, I did mailings to colleges. Once I found out, look, I thought I had the world's greatest job. I got an offer from McDonnell Douglas when I was looking for a job after I got laid off on the nuclear rocket program. And we had a successful test in Los Alamos, and Urgent had successful tests. So they canceled the program. Now, don't explain that to me, because I don't see an explanation. But anyway, I'm looking around for a job. I got a great job offer from Bob Wood at McDonnell Douglas. My job was going to be to figure out how flying saucers worked. Wow! I was very excited. And driving across the country, I was very disappointed to hear on the radio that the program that was going to support me was canceled. How'd you like to walk in for your first day on a job and they say, you realize we just laid off 5,000 people,
mm-hmm.
the manned orbiting laboratory program? Yeah, I realized that. They kept me for 3 months, but that's when I determined that they let me do whatever I wanted. And I was decided, I got a family to support, so I got on the phone and started calling colleges. And, you know, because of the two-hour time difference, I'm a cheapskate. You can call between 8 and between 6 and 8 in the morning, California time, for back east, you know. And so I did that, and I got a few lectures, and then I did mailings. I was doing mailings to 1,000 colleges at once.
Wow.
A lot of work. But if you're going to do it, you better do it, mm-hmm. you know. And I found that you're right. I was the only one on the circuit, really, that the student activities people had ever heard of. And I did something else, and this applies in a lot of other fields, but after we had a very successful lecture, I asked them to send me a letter, you know, indicating how well-received the lecture was and things like that. And I got a lot of those letters, and I sent copies of those letters when I did my next mail out. So you can't hide your light under a bushel. Nobody ever accused me of that, you understand?
Yes. Well, and it's been important because you got out there. Like you said, they didn't know about this topic. You know who else does this is Robert Hastings.
Yes.
Because when I was in school and you know, my cousin was in school, we would get those, and sometimes they would come to us because we were part of these paranormal groups and say, hey, who is this guy? Is this someone that we should have come to the college? And
good.
It's great that he does that, too, because he's excellent. You know, his work is wonderful.
Yes.
And he's getting out there to people outside of this UFO community circle. He's getting to the masses like you were doing way back when before him.
He does a good job, and I've been proud to say good things about it when people have asked me. And it's not a question of rivalry. It's a question of we're both on the same team trying to educate the world, mm-hmm. which has, after all, there are some nasty, noisy negativists, as I call them when I'm being polite,
mm-hmm.
naysaying newsmen, fossilized physicists, but I'm not so polite. And PR is an important part of the world, like it or not. I mean, maybe that's not the way it should be. Everything should be determined by publications and scientific journals, blah, blah, blah. But the world doesn't work that way.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I was wary when I started lecturing in the mid-60s that somebody's going to give me such a hard time, I'll never want to speak again. And so I tried to think of all the objections and answer them in my lecture. And I remember speaking to sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. Now, I'm a member, AIAA. And I was wary when I first got out there. Who's going to give me a hard time? And I was greatly pleased that in over 700 lectures, I've only had 11 hecklers, and two of them were drunk.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't had them, one of them in a long time. So there's a moral to this story. That is, if you stick to the facts, if you recognize your audience as being respectable, responsible, and use the tools of logic and science and data and a little humor maybe thrown in, you can get through. And I've spoken to lots of technical groups. A big was that Engineering Society of Detroit. I spoke to several sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, several sections of the National Management Association, management clubs for places like McDonnell Douglas and, you know, quite respectable institutions. So I was testing the waters, and I found there's, if you stick to the facts and respect your audience, people will listen. And mm-hmm. I try to encourage other people. I'm not trying to hold the world to myself, but I tell people there are a couple of rules. Never lie and have facts in hand before putting mouth in gear. Because, you know, you're going to answer questions. And you can't say, well, I'll get back to you tomorrow on that. You know, you got to do your homework. So these are tools that have nothing to do with UFOs. It has to do with whatever you're talking about,
mm-hmm.
especially if it's controversial at all. So I've enjoyed it. And, you know, I'm a Leo. I like being out in front of the crowds, and I'm lucky on that score. There were two things. One, I enjoy being on the stage. And two, at that time at least, my memory was excellent. And at first, I was wary of, did I get things right, make sure I didn't say anything that wasn't true. And when I'd go back and check, oh, yeah, okay, I got it right. My memory was working then.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's working now. That's a different story. So I took advantage of that, and I could relax.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I'm not afraid to say, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's an important one. And I would imagine your debate experience was really important as well, because
yes.
And it's sort of a problem, I think, that we have now is this fear to debate each other when people hold their ground so tightly, they're not open to being doubted. And so there's a lot of contention that gets, whereas, you know, you learned early on in debate to respect your opponent.
Oh, yeah. You got to know both sides of the story, too, mm-hmm. incidentally.
It reminds me of I can't remember what. Oh, Kevin Randall. You know, he kind of got thrown into debating on Roswell, and they were like, "What side do you want?" And he chose the underdog just for the hell of it. He didn't even know much about any of it, and that's what got him into it in the first time. So, the knowing the both sides is important, and having that ability to respect both sides. And you and I have debated before on things, and many others. And of course, it's fun to do that because we learn. That's how we learn from each other.
Yeah. And the thing is that you should have the goal of getting at the truth, not of having your ego put forward.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
It's not a question of who's winning. It's let's get the facts out there, and maybe you'll learn something. Maybe you'll change your view the next time. Who knows? But I've enjoyed it. And, but I must say I'm less fleet of foot, so to speak, mentally now than I was 50 years ago. My first lecture was in 1967. Boy, that seemed forever ago.
That was quite a while ago, and I'm assuming that you were a young physicist at that time.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah, I was working for Westinghouse Astronuclear Lab, and we had an active group in Pittsburgh, and we even a UFO Research Institute. And I was an active member, and I eventually became president of the group, but... And we sponsored a talk at Carnegie Institute, and had a big crowd, and they paid a little money to get in, and the response was great. What I'm trying to say is everybody was so wary, especially back then. You're going to say flying saucers are real, and I chose that topic, that title, intentionally. You know, and I put an exclamation point after the real, and I put R in caps. Let's make clear that we've taken a stand here. And it wasn't, are flying saucers real? But flying saucers are real. And it worked. What I'm saying is that drew people. It didn't bother them. And, I've often had record crowds. And, sometimes they try to put you on the spot. I did a lecture at the University of Manitoba. We had a packed house, people sitting in the stairways, it was an auditorium kind of thing with sloping upward from the speaker. And at the end of the lecture, which was very well received, there were over 600 people there, somebody got up in the question and answer period, and one of the first questions was, how about polling this audience? Because I'd given some data from the Gallup polls, which showed, much to people's surprise, that the greater the education, the more likely to believe in flying saucers and stuff like that. How about polling this audience, he said. You know, I couldn't tell what side of the aisle he was on, but I said, well, usually I'm the one who sticks his neck out, not asking the audience to. Well, I don't think anybody would mind. Everybody claps. Okay. I asked two questions. I told them, I'll ask you two questions. How many think some UFOs are alien spacecraft? I probably said intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft. And how many think no UFOs are intelligently controlled extraterrestrial spacecraft? I'll ask you both questions. So I did that. More than 90% said they thought some were.
Wow.
This was after my lecture, you understand. Mm-hmm. And a common comment that I got through all this meandering around the world was that, gee, I didn't know that.
Right.
I never heard of those studies. And I got a little sneaky. Early on, I often would say, I'd talk about five large-scale scientific studies, and I'd say, how many of you have read this after I talk about it? And typically, a few, two or three or four.
Right.
And so that served a purpose. It made people aware that, A, they weren't the only one who didn't know anything, and, B, there was a lot of people who didn't know much about the subject.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we ought to listen to find out about something. And, it was one of the things...
We've got to take a break right now. So
okay.
We'll be right back, and we'll finish that thought, because that goes into a lot of The other people you debate that should know more but don't, and we'll talk about that when we get back. But you're listening to Open Mind UFO Radio. I'm happy to have Stanton Friedman here with me. We'll be back after this short break. If you're listening to the podcast, you'll hear a short music interlude. Otherwise, if you're listening on KGRA, you'll hear a few commercials from some of the people that keep KGRA going. So pay attention and patronize these people. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to Open Mind UFO Radio. I am your host, Alejandro Rojas, and I'm talking with Stanton Friedman. And we're talking about how in your lectures, you know, people often didn't know much about this topic before you started talking. And we'll get more into that. But there was something else that you talked about, you know, being wary and how you took that bold kind of stance to name your lecture, you know, Flying Saucers Are Real. It must have taken quite a bit for a young physicist to even get involved with this controversial field, especially when you're trying to, you know, develop your career. And I'm sure you had thoughts too as how this would impact your career.
I was wary. Mm-hmm. I certainly was wary. However, the response from the professional groups early on, like the Engineering Society of Detroit and the Engineering Society of Cincinnati and several sections of the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics, nobody can say these are a bunch of believers. And the response at Los Alamos, I worry a little bit. It was the Los Alamos section of the American Nuclear Society. And Westinghouse paid for me to go there to talk to them, which was a compliment in the first place. But there were over 400 people there, and there weren't any nasty questions.
Wow.
And so, you know, after you go through this enough times, you realize it's okay. Stick to the facts. Never lie. Have yourself be prepared for whoever's going to ask what. And, you know, I've had 11 hecklers in over 700 lectures, and two of them were drunk. It was funny, after one lecture, you realize that guy was drunk, the first guy that stood up. And the thing is, you learn to keep your cool. One guy, first up in the question and answer period, I just call on the first guy who stands up, and he said, "I've never heard so much nonsense in one night in my life." Great way to start. You know?
Yeah.
I said, "Can you please be a little more specific, sir?" I wouldn't have told you what I was going to say, but that's what I did say. And so he said, "Well, you said that Biddy and Barney Hill were taken on board a UFO and went off to Zeta Reticuli and back in 2 hours." And I said, "No, sir. What I said was they were taken on board a UFO. They remained for 2 hours. They didn't go anywhere." And he had a couple more like that. No, that's not what I said. And then somebody in the audience said, "How about taking some sensible questions?" This guy gets up and leaves.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "I'll answer your question, but who was that?"
Yeah.
He was a professor of physics.
Oh, he was. And interesting.
He obviously didn't know anything about the subject and certainly wasn't going to admit that.
Well, I guess we'll get into this now because that does make me think of course, some of the other people, especially one of the people you debate often is Zess Shostak of SETI. You've had several debates with him. And you know what?
Yes.
I've talked to him. I'm a big fan of his. And he reminds me of you a bit in that you're both very witty and entertaining. But he, over the years, despite having fielded questions in this arena and being asked even in mainstream media about this topic, seems to very much resist wanting to educate himself because he still talks in generalities And even though he's posed questions to me before and you and others and saying, you know, astronomers would be into this. So you're like, okay, well, look at Peter Sturrock. Look at, you know, Hynek and some of these. Hynek did a report on astronomers and UFOs. Look at that.
Yeah.
But he doesn't look at any of this. There's no indication that he's looked at any of the research that answers the questions he's had.
I asked in the course of one encounter we had, how many, he was in the audience, and after each of five large-scale scientific studies, I asked how many people here read this, and he hadn't read any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And umpteen years later, he still hadn't read any of them.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable thing in today's world with professional people. Look, I like Seth. He's a nice guy. I respect him. He's done a lot to get people interested in life in outer space, although I was kind of shocked when he said recently, well, he lost the debate to me, which he did, but that doesn't mean he was right. You know, don't bother me with the facts. My mind's made up.
Yeah.
And that's the attitude here, that especially the astronomers who seem to think they should be the ones who answer all UFO questions. I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
What do they know about advanced technology, for example? One of the big questions, can you get here from there? I worked on nuclear fission rockets, which we successfully tested on the ground. The biggest one, I'm still impressed. One of the highlights of my industrial career, the test was out at the nuclear test site in Nevada. And the thing operated... for the full 60 minutes, it was at a power level of 1,000 megawatts. Now, Hoover Dam produces 2,000, so you get an idea. Here's a reactor system that's less than 8 feet in diameter. And the exhaust temperature, liquid hydrogen, goes in very cold and comes out very hot, 4,000 degrees. It was a very impressive test, and we, frankly, I have to admit it, we had no idea how long this thing going to run. Maybe the fuel elements will come out. I mean, operating at 4,000 degrees is not a normal environment for equipment these days, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And they announced the temperature and pressure 5 minutes, 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and that all those things were nominal, and gee, we might make it. The maximum time we could operate was 60 minutes because he couldn't store enough liquid hydrogen to go more than that because you needed it for aftercooling. And we got the full 60 minutes. And I wouldn't have been surprised. Nobody would have been. And I was particularly worried. I shouldn't admit it, but I am. I was particularly worried because they asked me between a week and 2 weeks before the test, Stan, we don't know whether the control elements are going to be cooled enough that they might not melt down. Can you get some information for us what the radiation levels will be at them, the neutron levels and so forth? Okay, so I ran some experiments. I got help with people down at the nuclear test site and so forth. And yeah, it'll work. It'll be okay. But I'll tell you, when we started the test, my feeling was, I hope that thing works, because if it doesn't, they're going to blame me.
Well, you know, go ahead.
No, just that was a highlight, that the successful testing of a real system.
Mm-hmm.
And I found most people have no idea that we'd done that, and especially the astronomical community. Look, I worked on a study of fusion propulsion for deep space travel.
Yeah.
When I was at Aerojet, this is back in 1962, and we concluded that fusion would do the job. If you had the dough, you could go. And so that's a long time ago, and you'd think the astronomers would be wise on that subject, because all the stars, every single one of them, produces its energy by nuclear fusion. But none of them know about fusion or fission propulsion, and the kicker here is we didn't even know there was such a thing as fission or fusion until 1938. We didn't even know there were neutrons until 1932.
Hmm.
So one needs to realize that unlike Bishop Usher, who said the world was created in 4004 B.C., the Earth is over 4 billion years old, and we're just finding out how the sun works in 1938. Back in the 20s, 1920s, we thought the sun was a mass of burning gas. Who knew from nuclear fusion? Well, the reason I bring up fusion all the time to people, why are you talking about that? You're not going to use H-bombs to, well, you might, but the kicker is almost all the energy in the universe is produced by nuclear fusion in the stars. It's not a mass of burning gas. And there's so much more energy per pound, if you will. A quick example, a big bomb in World War II produced the energy of 10 tons of dynamite. Wow, a blockbuster, they called it. 10 tons of dynamite. That was in 44. 1945, first A bomb, 16,000 tons of dynamite. That's how much energy. First fusion bomb, 1952, 10 million tons. One stinking bomb. And the Russians set off Tsar Bomba, 27 million tons of TNT. That's how much energy was released by this one lousy bomb. What I'm saying is bombs are one thing, and yes, they're a means of destruction, but they can also be used for propulsion, the process.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I say man can go to the stars, I mean it. I worked on a fission nuclear rocket. It operated successfully. So did Los Alamos. Theirs is even bigger, 4,000 megawatts. Exhaust temperature 4,000 degrees. Now, that's a realm that nobody talks about. You know, and this that was these are all back before 1970, for God's sakes.
Yeah, so it's interesting that they stick to that line, you know, that, you know, it's too far, we can't get there. I asked Michio Kaku, the one chance I had a few seconds with him, and the question I asked was around this, you know, because he talks so much about the other civilizations and types that he believes are likely out there. And
yes.
I asked him, well, why do you feel that, you know, SETI is, why do they continue with this response that, you know, these distances are too far? And he said, his reply with a smirk was, they're astronomers. What do they know about physics or theoretical physics? So kind of really along the lines of what you're saying as well.
Yeah, I talked to him. I was interviewed by him. He had a radio program back way back when, and we were both participated in the program in Saudi Arabia, of all places. How do you like that?
Oh, yeah, that one. I think Jacques Vallée had something to do with that.
Yes, Jacques did, and there were a couple of other people. And one guy I didn't really know, but then Michio and Jacques and myself, and I forget who the other guy was. But
Nick Pope, I think.
Yeah, who?
Was Nick Pope one of them?
No.
Oh, okay.
I don't think so. But it was an interesting experience, especially when I called them after they had invited me out of the blue. I didn't know who they were. They had a fancy name for the event. And I actually checked to make sure there was such an event. And then I finally decided I better check on something else because people were saying, Stan, are you crazy? You're a Jewish. You're going to Saudi Arabia? And so I called the person, a woman, as a matter of fact, who was handling things, and mentioned that, you know, I don't want to go there and then have somebody at the door say, you can't come in. It's a long way. It was a long way. She said, no, there's no problem. We've had other Jewish speakers at these symposia. And there wasn't. There wasn't. I was treated perfectly normally, and I had dinner with several meals at this conference with we weren't sitting at the same seat each time, so you got to associate with a lot of them. And there wasn't a bit of problem like that. I could have been at my father's cousin's club. I was comfortable. And I want to stress that. I mean, you know, people forget the golden age of Jews and Arabs was in Spain back in like the 13th century. There was great respect. And so that's one of the nice things. I spoke in China. I had no idea how I would be, what the response would be. They were very nice and sensible. They asked questions, sure, but there was no putting down the subject or putting me down or, you know, it was okay. And I say that not to brag about me, but to get people to recognize that it's okay to learn about this subject and to talk about it. Just make sure you have your facts straight. That's all.
Mm-hmm. So when you first got involved, what motivated you then to get involved with this subject, especially, you know, like we talked about earlier, early on in your building your career?
I was interested in far-out technology. Mm. You know, my first job, I was working on radiation shielding for nuclear airplanes. And many people aren't aware that our program in 1958 spent $100 million
Whoa.
At General Electric. That's not six professors and 12 grad students, now you understand. So I had, there were a lot of other people involved, and I didn't have a PhD. Many of our people did. But I was interested in far-out stuff, working on nuclear airplanes and then nuclear rockets, and doing a study of nuclear fusion for deep space travel. I was really excited about, holy cow, we can do these things. And so the first lecture was an accident. Somebody heard me on the radio because they needed entertainment for their book review club that was reading Frank Edwards' book. Sure, why not? I didn't even get paid for it. I got a dinner out of it, I think, come to think of it. But I was intrigued by the technology aspects. And then I was intrigued, once I started doing my homework, at how much data there was that nobody seemed to know about. I'm the one who brought into prominence Blue Book Special Report 14, biggest study ever done. On a scientific study. It was done by Battelle Memorial Institute in Columbus, Ohio. And as it happens, I had a contract with, where I was involved with Battelle, at looking at, it was an Air Force contract, and they were the best source of information. What did the Russians know about nuclear power in space? And let's see, it had a fancy title, Analysis and Evaluation of Fast and Intermediate Reactors for Space Vehicle Applications. The word Soviet was nowhere there. And I was not even allowed to keep a copy of my final report. So I was involved in this far-out stuff, and this is pretty early in my professional career. And then once I started speaking and remembered all the debating stuff, I got hooked. I enjoyed speaking, and I enjoyed the challenge of keeping ahead of the opposition, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And, I was very terribly disappointed when I was supposed to have the debate of the century on April the 8th in Vancouver at a big auditorium. I was supposed to debate Michael Shermer of the Skeptic Society. And get a nice fee on top of it, as a matter of fact. And it was canceled. I still don't know why. Maybe I was too eager. I don't know.
Yeah. Well,
but
and now, after all of these years, now that we're almost running out of time, we didn't get to. I'll have to have you back because I want to talk to you a lot about the state of things now. But I think what we touched upon is really important. But now, after all of these years, you're talking about retirement from UFOs.
Yes.
So that's finally going to happen.
Well, I think so. I think I do have two lectures scheduled after Roswell that have been, I'm not going to cancel them just because I'm retiring. People made an honest commitment, and they've got an audience, and that'll increase the attendance, I'm sure. One of his last lectures. But, look, I'm going to be 84 in July. It's time. They used to say when you played sports, you're a step slower going to first base. Well, I'm three or four steps slower. so it's about time. And also, I've never really retired. I mean, I've been speaking since, 51 years now. And so it would be nice to have a little time for my wife and I to do things. Her not worrying about me traveling all over the place. I got to some weird places.
What Lee and I were talking about, Lee Spiegel, were talking about this, and he made a great point that I'm sure you by far have done the most UFO lectures than anyone ever.
700 or so, yeah.
Probably way more, probably double your next closest person, whoever that would be. That's been your thing. You've done so many of them and educated so many different varieties and diverse groups of people on this topic.
Yeah, well, look, I've enjoyed it. I wouldn't do it if I didn't enjoy it. But, mm-hmm. you know, I get to see all kinds of places. Warsaw, I've spoken in.
Wow.
Real good response in the Polish UFO Society. And I've spoken in Finland and Argentina and Ecuador. That was a weird one. They told me I would be the only one at this huge conference that would be very well attended. There'd be loads of media people there. And they wanted me to put up the money for the trip, and I said, no way. So I'm glad I didn't.
Yeah.
And anyway, they brought me in, and it was a very small crowd with outdoor plumbing for the restrooms. And it's just a good thing they paid, at least they didn't make any money on the talk, that's for sure. But it was a different sort of experience. And I have to, you know, A.J. Gavard,
mm-hmm.
and he was there, and as a matter of fact, he drove me there from, he met me in Sao Paulo, and we drove over to Ecuador, and the translator was a high school kid who had a course in English.
Oh, wow.
And A.J. was listening, and said, hey, let me do this, please.
How funny.
And he did. So, you know, that was an experience.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of little things along the way, but I've enjoyed it. I've spoken in 19 countries.
Wow.
50 states, 10 provinces. See the world. Like I said, be a ufologist.
That's amazing. Well, we're out of time. This has been a lot of fun, really eye-opening, and important, I think, to guide people, because a lot of what you did back then is still doable right now. And
sure.
And you've paved the way for people. Now it's much easier to do what you did because of you doing this when you did. So thank you so much for everything you've done. We'll have to have you on again in the next few weeks so we could talk more. We'll make this part one.
All right.
And
it won't snow the next time.
Hopefully not, but where you are, you never know. Thank you so much to Stanton for joining us this week, and it's going to be a lot of fun to check back with him. I'm going to try to do it like maybe on a monthly basis, huh? And hopefully you all don't mind. I find him terribly interesting. He truly is a national treasure, and it's a lot of fun because, you know, he's such a kind of media darling. Every time, you know, for me, I pay a lot of attention to, you know, the media coming and interviewing people at different events and stuff like that. And it's so easy to put Stanton in front of people and they fall in love with him. He always shares great information. And so it's one of the things, one of the many skills he has that will be sorely missed as he leaves the field, unfortunately. This is so sad, but that means we got to spend a lot of time with him before he goes, and so that's why we'll have him on the show quite a bit in the coming month. So that'll be great. Thank you so much, Stan. Also, thank you so much to Martin Willis of Podcast UFO, who helps us out with the news at the beginning of the show. Remember, you can see all the stories we talked about at openminds.tv. That Linda Zimmerman great St. Patrick's thing is there. And it's so much information that is coming out these days with the DOD and Luis Elizondo and all of that. So I'm still unpacking it. We'll have some stories there. And I can tell you we'll have more exclusive Elizondo interviews on the horizon. We're still in contact, and I should be meeting up with him soon, actually, in the next couple of weeks. So very excited about that. Thank you to Caleb Hanks, who does the opening and close music. Thanks to Systematics, who created the bumper music. And thank you to you, all the listeners. Thank you for being here every week. And thank you to those of you who said hi at the conference and at other places in the last couple of weeks. That reminds me, next weekend, this coming weekend, I'm going to be in Boise at Treefort. I'm going to be at something called Hackfort, where I'm going to be talking about the media and tech, but also I'm going to have a panel that I'll be moderating with Ben Hansen and Mark D'Antonio, where we're going to talk about the tech of UFOs and the paranormal. So that's Treefort. Look it up. Until next time, adios, muchachos.